Hillary, you've been pretty busy the last couple of weeks, and you and the team have been talking to people in America.
We had the pleasure a couple of weeks ago of interviewing Bren Smith, and we're going to show the interview.
Can you just set up because what the situation? I recorded this interview.
Yes, I recorded this interview in Collingwood, and in a small podcast studio, a little sound studio, and it is basically we did it over Skype, basically, video interview. What's happened though? And Bren Smith is about 3D ocean farming, so he's going to explain what that is, and it's fascinating. And he is a visionary and a leader, and all about community. What's happened though? There was a visual hiccup with him coming from the States. So we don't have him physically talking. Like you'll see my mug. You are lucky enough to watch me talk. Lucky people. And, so there's me talking and a picture of Bren.
Cool.
But we're having a conversation for about half an hour. If you'd like, as I said earlier, it's like a radio chat.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you can either look out in the ocean, don't have to watch me, and or close your eyes. Just pretend you're listening to the radio for about half an hour because it's only going to come out of the screen.
Okay.
What do you reckon?
Okay, cool. Up for that?
Are you up for that?
Liam, are you ready to go?
Because he couldn't make it. His baby, well, when we spoke, was 5 weeks old, so she would be like 7 weeks old now, and he just could not get here. It's now my pleasure to introduce my interview with Bren Smith. Bren Smith, welcome to the Apollo Bay Seafood Festival, virtually at least, but welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is such an honour. And hello to everybody.
Yes, we've had a couple of sessions this morning already. I'm timing it well. So there you go. But tell us a bit about you. I'm really excited to have you as part of our discussions and conversations on the edge today. Tell us at first about who you are and where you are right now.
Yeah, so my name's Bren Smith, and I'm a former commercial fisherman, and now I'm a regenerative ocean farmer, and I'm based here in Long Island Sound, just outside of New York City. Mm-hmm. And I'm out there growing a mix of shellfish and seaweeds. And I tell you, I never thought as a commercial fisherman that I'd end up growing vegetables. That was not, it sounds kind of boring, like I can't go to the same bars I used to, you know?
I love the stories up, just you know? Don't count. There's no weight to the stories, huh?
Yeah. But it's been a journey, and it's great to be here. I live in an old 1870s oyster captain's house with my wife and my new kid. Yep, right on the water. Yeah.
Right on the water. So tell us what led you to becoming, from a fisherman, a commercial fisherman, to an ocean farmer. What was the first seed, when you started to think, hang on, something's got to change?
Yeah. So, I mean, I look back over my shoulder and I think it's sort of a journey of ecological redemption. I was born and raised in Newfoundland, Canada, you know, the world famous cod grounds, a little town on the most eastern point of all North America. You know, all our houses were painted red, greens, blues. We used to paint them in bright colored boat paint so we could find our way home in the in the fog. You know,
like seriously, little signs, landmarks everywhere. Wow, I didn't.
Yeah, right next to a fisherman's co-op, you know. So kids selling cod tongues door to door. Just what we think of as sort of the beautiful, iconic artisanal fishery. And yes. So I dropped out of high school when I was 14, and decided to go out to sea. And I fished in Gloucester, in the United States, and in Lynn. For everything, tuna, lobster, cod, and then I ended up in the Bering Sea in Alaska, fishing cod and crab. So I fished a lot of places. The trouble was, and I loved it, like I still miss that job, right? The thrill of being in.
Was this a long, how many years was your career sort of up to this point?
That was about a decade.
About
a decade. And I've been pushed off the ocean many times, right? And that's kind of the journey and trying to find my way back. But, you know, I miss being a commercial fisherman because, you know, the solidarity of being in the belly of a boat for, you know, 3 months at a time, 13 other people, that humility of being in 40-foot seas, and that sense of meaning of helping feed my country.
Yes.
Is really important. You know, there are certain jobs, steel workers, farmers, coal miners, and fishermen that have this identity of like building, feeding, powering the country. That it's not just a job, it's like a sense of meaning. And it's like we call them in Newfoundland, they're jobs that we can write and sing songs about.
Yes.
And so the question for us here is like, how do we give people like me in the era of climate change still jobs that we can sing songs about?
That is beautiful, because I was about to say you're rewriting the tunes, clearly, with what you're what you're doing. So you were saying you really loved the camaraderie and loved the connection and the, I guess, responsibility that tangible connection to feeding people. So what happened with it? So you obviously stopped, and what made you think 3D farming?
The cod stocks crashed back home in Newfoundland. Overnight, 30,000 people thrown out of work, and it is amazing. As a young person, to realize that sort of if we don't protect our ecosystems, it's not an environmental issue, it's an economic issue. Like, there are no jobs on a dead ocean, right?
Exactly.
And so, and I'd always thought of like the environment as saving seals and birds and bees, and honestly, that's not my thing, right?
Yeah.
But it turns out that
Come on.
That's for those folks, you know? But
I'm getting excited, sorry. Go ahead.
But we have this common interest now. And I think that's been that was the wake up call of like, okay, how do I change my relationship to the ocean? I didn't know what that meant then, right? But it's been this 20-year journey. And I went to the aquaculture farms, the salmon farms in Canada. Yep. And that was supposed to be the great answer to overfishing, right? And we're going to feed millions of people. We were going to, you know, be the new, and transform fishermen into fish farmers. And at that point, it was, you know, immediately it was clear it wasn't a job for me. We were using antibiotics, pesticides, you know, there were net breaks. The fish tasted terrible. And aquaculture had made the mistake that land-based agriculture had. Which is like taking all these sort of hyper monoculture industrial systems and working against nature instead of with it.
Yes.
In order to farm. And this was just as land-based farming was trying to like unfoil its mistakes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Aquaculture came in. And now aquaculture is the worst brand name in the grocery store in America.
Really?
Right?
In America?
Yep.
So
then I left that disillusioned. And I ended up in Long Island Sound. I chased a woman there, you know, the hard
on. Human always, as well.
But too much so. So I ended up in Long Island Sound, and basically the worst place on earth, which was the suburbs of Connecticut. Had no idea what to do. And then I discovered shell fishing, oyster farming. And so I started out as an oyster farmer, and it was totally different. Like, I killed millions of oysters. I was running a death camp because I had no idea, right? I mean, like, I chase things. I'm a hunter, and here are these things, and I just killed them all year after year, right? I was the worst farmer. But slowly I developed a blue thumb, and I ran an oyster farm for about 7 years, and then the hurricanes came in and destroyed my farm 2 years in a row. Then I had to figure. I found myself sort of yet again on the front lines of a environmental crisis. Now climate change, and I had to remake myself. You know, from a fisherman, then trying a salmon farmer to an oysterman, and now into something else. And so that's when I redesigned my farm, and took the lessons of 5,000 years of different kinds of regenerative ocean farming, and just tried to apply it and bring it together. And that's how I ended up, and now I'm growing, you know, a whole mix of different species in 20-acre areas. And, I think I hang out with more arugula farmers now than fishermen.
Yeah.
It's been tough. But it's the, you know, we all have to make our transitions in the era of climate change. So I had to give up that part of my soul, but I still get to own my own boat.
Yes.
Have a self-directed life, succeed and fail on my own terms, and I get to die on my boat one day, which is the goal, and I still get to feed my community. So that's a job I can respect and I want to pass on, and that we can sing a song about. So that's been the journey.
Wow. Can you just touch on something for me for a moment? You said 5,000 years of history. Tell us a capsule. I didn't realize that ocean farming like that has that kind of history to it. Where did you start researching?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, I'm often portrayed as someone who invented, you know, this type of vertical polyculture ocean farming, and I didn't. I just borrowed you know, research, talk to people. You know, individual inspiration is a total myth, right?
Yes.
And so as I dug into this, and I did a lot of this, I just did a book, Eat Like a Fish, and, you know, we looked back and this whole history. And, you know, Native Americans, First Nations folks were building clam walls thousands of years ago. Right,
yes,
and then the Romans were farming oysters. The mussel farming was discovered by an Irishman who got shipwrecked in France. He put out a net in order to capture some birds because he was hungry, and mussels stuck to the nets, and that was the beginning of mussel farming. Right.
Yep.
And on and on and on. And I think what I've done then is take all these different systems that have been apart and brought them into one polyculture model. How do we grow as many species in one area as possible using the whole water column and things like that?
Can you paint a picture of a typical day? Because I'm imagining every day is different. But what is it that you grow? And how is it harvested? And is it seasonal? Things like that.
Totally.
Like, how does it work?
Sure. So you can kind of imagine an underwater garden where we actually, I run eco tours and they're expensive, like $500. You come out and it's the biggest ripoff in the agents in the industry because you come out on the boat and there's kind of like nothing to see. They're like, we're going to come out and see an ocean park. It's just some freaking buoys out there. Right. But that's a good thing. Right. We have a low aesthetic impact. I think that's important. But just imagine anchors at the bottom and then ropes to the surface and some buoys. And then lines about 10 feet below horizontal, right? So like an underwater rope scaffolding system. And from those ropes, we grow our kelp, which is a type of seaweed, vertically downwards. We have mussels in mussel socks, scallops in something called lantern nets. We have cages with oysters and clams down below. And I think what's key is, listen, the fish farmers will figure it out. They're really trying to figure out how to do this right. As a farmer, if you ask the ocean what to grow, I mean, the history of aquaculture is like, okay, let's grow what people want to eat. So people like to eat salmon and tuna, let's grow them. No one asked, okay, what's unique about the ocean as an agricultural space? And when you ask the ocean, what do you want us to grow? It says something very simple. Why don't you grow things that don't swim away and you don't have to feed? And that just creates a really great business model. I use no fresh water, no fertilizer, no feed. It's zero input food, making it the most sustainable form of food production on the planet. And the species that we grow are regenerative. So our kelp soaks up more carbon than land-based plants and forests. It's the sequoia of the sea, nitrogen filter. I mean, oysters filter nitrogen out of the water column.
Yep.
The farms function as artificial reef systems. So as a farmer's suddenly, you know, my role is to participate in a complex system and sort of nurture Mother Nature's complexity and work with her, as opposed to be like, okay, chefs like salmon. I'm going to grow salmon, which I just I think is kind of crazy because they swim away. It's just cheaper when things don't – you don't have to jail things.
Yeah. Do you have a lot of fish, though, when you say an artificial reef kind of scenario? Do you have a lot of fish obviously coming in – living within the farm, and do you eat catch fish as well? Are fish part of a byproduct of your farm?
Yeah. So, you know, because there's all this structure, over 150 species come in, like, hide, eat, use it as an area. And some of the best commercial fishing and recreational fishing is actually on and around the farm because there's just so much activity and structure to build an ecosystem around. So yeah, we attract a lot of fish, which is great. I don't harvest any fish, but fishermen set gill nets around my farm to catch some of the fish that come in. Again, I'm agnostic on sort of the future of fish farming. I think it's still an environmental R&D phase. There's some big problems that need to be addressed. I really hope people address them. Just as a small-scale ocean farmer, it's easier to grow plants than animals. And and I do think we need to shift not just to, like, things that are more sustainable. So we can get fishing more sustainable. But sustainable isn't going to address climate change. It isn't going to breathe life back into the ecosystem. We need to grow things that are regenerative, that push beyond sustainability. And that's why – that's how we pick our crops.
I think that's the key word too, regenerative. And when you talked about the fishermen working around you. So does that mean, it might be an obvious question, you obviously have to connect with the job you used to do, people who used to be fishermen. Is that, has that been difficult, or have they, people, human beings don't like change. So I'm imagining when you started to do it, did you get a lot of pushback? And now how has that translated into working with fishermen?
Yeah. So, I mean, I was getting laughed off the docks. I mean, I got some fishing creds, which is good, you know what I mean? And like, but I was getting laughed off the docks. I mean, growing, and, you know, I was joking around, kind of lying with people. No, I'm growing hemp underwater. You know, like, no. This is a good idea. Trust
Keep
me.
Calm. Right?
Yeah. So I was just seen as, you know, ridiculous and kind of a fool, I think. But over time, I mean, this climate thing, as you all know, is happening way faster than we thought. It was supposed to be a slow lobster boil. It is here and now. So the effects in the fishing community. I just got a call about 6 months ago from a First Nations Indigenous community up in Alaska, and they said, "Can you come and work with us because the salmon did not come home this year because of water temp for a whole bunch of climate reasons." So basically, I was getting laughed off the docks a decade ago, and now Mother Nature is having all these impacts, and just fish aren't here. There are no lobsters in Long Island Sound now. It used to be the biggest industry here. There were millions and millions of dollars. There's just literally nothing. They fled north, on and on. So that's driven fishermen to us. So, you know, I now work with we've got a nonprofit called Greenwave, which is training the next generation of ocean farmers. And we've got 11th generation fishermen. That's like lobstermen, gill netters. I've got a ton of salmon fishermen up in Alaska. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting, we have those, but we also have folks from all walks of life. So we have we looked at who we're working with in this sector, and majority are women, which is really surprising. I thought it was going to be all like, you know, sort of continually partially drunk, grumpy guys like me.
Yeah.
But we looked at this, and it's people like Catherine Puckett, who's here in Block Island, who has a pink boat.
Right.
She grows oysters, clams, and kelp, seaweeds, an all-male crew. They hate working on a pink boat. They hate it. Like, and they talk about it all the time. But they love it. They got these full-time jobs on this island. And she calls herself the oyster wench. And maybe that's like the new face and the new beginning of what the ocean economy – maybe it's really going to look different. It won't just be like fishermen. Maybe women will be taking the lead. We have a lot of young land-based farmers who can't afford land here, all coming us asking to become ocean farmers. We have a waiting list now of 4,000 people.
Wow, just in the States or around
just
the world?
Just in the U.S., we have requests from 110 countries. Just in the U.S., 4,000. No, there's no way we can meet all that demand.
Yes.
But there's just people from all walks of life coming to do with that. I mean, listen, our seas are rising. Mm-hmm. We're going to have – and we can either flee our coasts and build walls, or we can turn around and embrace the ocean.
Yeah.
And you know, I might be farming in Wall Street in a couple of years if the waters keep rising, like in between the skyscrapers. You know what I mean? like, but we got to – you know, I think it's time to embrace the sea and really work with it. The beautiful thing is it is a – area that can play a key role in climate change. If you were to take 3.8% of U.S. waters and farm just seaweeds through a network, you could compensate for the entire carbon footprint of California's ag system.
So we can – is a goal of yours to become global if you've got such a wait list? Like where do you start in growing GreenWave? Because I want to talk to you about GreenWave and also about GreenWave in Australia. Is that – Do you have requests from people here?
We definitely do. I mean, we see ourselves as sort of a network, and we want as many people, you know, sort of joining and being part of this effort as possible, because we need, you know, people in hatcheries, we need economists, we need a policy people, we need entrepreneurs doing value-added products. And so GreenWave is just a way for, you know, a place for all of us to congregate around the globe. And we work right now in Alaska, California, New York, and then throughout New England, and then we're working in Newfoundland back home, and we're working in New Zealand some as well. I think there's huge potential. The one thing I just want to say is that it's like this isn't just about food. Like, Like, we can make this delicious food with chefs. One of the best dishes we have is a barbecue kelp noodles with parsnips and breadcrumbs.
Yum.
And that's amazing because it's got the barbecue sauce, which is the heat, the parsnips, the roundness, the crunch of the breadcrumbs. And you don't even think of it as seaweed, right?
Nice.
So the chefs, I can grow this stuff, but it's chefs' jobs and the home chefs to make this delicious climate cuisine, right? Mm-hmm. And if folks can't make the seaweeds delicious, they should get out of the kitchen. This is what they're put on earth to do, right? Is to make a new climate cuisine. Not to say, give me salmon, give me these things, but give me what the earth can make
what
sense
the earth can
to
offer.
Provide.
Yeah.
Yeah. And remember, there are 10,000 plants in the ocean we can begin our journey of growing, right? This is a very exciting space as a farmer and as a chef. There are arugulas, tomatoes, corn, stuff that we've never
Are you tapping into those vegetables now? Are you starting to grow those?
Yeah, so we're all around the country. We're growing a different mix. It really has to be very site specific,
right?
Of what to grow and what is economically viable, right? One of the things we're finding is the farm of the future is going to grow food, but we also use all of our waste now for fertilizer for organic land based farmers, feed. Like if you feed – some of the best research in the world comes out of Australia with methane on if you feed a 2% diet to cows of seaweed, you get a 58% reduction in methane output. Stunning.
So simple,
and that comes out of Australia.
Amazing.
Yeah. And now it's spread all over the globe. We also are doing bioplastics, so straws out of seaweed and packaging, which is amazing. So that's the whole waste stream. But we're also harvesting data. So we have sensors on our farms. And we take that data and sell it to tech companies in order to track the changes of the ocean.
Well, and data's then the new oil, really, isn't it? You know,
exactly. good or bad, so, right?
Yeah, exactly. But so go on, you're harvesting information.
Yeah, and so then the last thing I'd say, food, ag products, we harvest data, and then also ecosystem services, so like carbon, blue carbon, and nitrogen. So because we're carbon sinks. So the farmer of the future, like it's food, but it's all these other pieces. And that's how you create a resilient farm that has multiple sources of income, is very resilient in the sort of dynamic era of climate change.
That's great. And it's something you can write songs about too.
Yeah.
Seriously, there's so many connections there. I love it.
Exactly.
I did ask, send a question through to you about our Great Barrier Reef. It's, you know, world famous. It's breathtaking. I've been lucky enough to snorkel over it a few times, and it's in trouble. I wondered if someone called you and said, come on over, Bren, help us. How would it look around the – what would GreenWave do in terms of ocean farming to help our beautiful reef?
Absolutely. So what's interesting is we actually had a I think her name was Joe Lane from Eden in Australia come, and she started a company called Sea Health that does wild harvested kelp, but she's doing a landscape analysis all over Australia of places that can be used to grow seaweeds. And so she's an incredible resource right there. And then in Tasmania, there are some folks doing reforestation of seaweeds, incredible work. And then some of the really great tech companies. Smart Oysters is one of them that's now getting into seaweed. Like there's a lot of activity in Australia already that I really suggest folks reach out to. It's really exciting. Something like the Great Barrier Reef. I mean, you know, not everybody's going to agree with me about this, but it's like we have to get beyond the idea of conservation because it's its form of climate denial, right? We could set aside the entire ocean as a conservation zone and it's going to die. We need something breathing life back into the ocean, right?
Yes.
And I'd argue that is regenerative ocean farming, that you need your conservation zones, but you need farms dotted inside, sequestering that carbon, recreating reefs for the ecosystems, and really just sort of holding the line on climate change. So I think what – on something like Great Barrier Reef, and I'm not an expert at all, but – you know, I would train 1,000 young people to become the new foresters of the Great Barrier Reef. Too, there are some great folks who do, but coral. But we also do seaweeds. And let's every year be planting more and more. That's job creation. And then you can farm some of that.
Yes.
It's like agroforestry model, but it's mainly a reforestation effort like we're doing. You know, people are doing this all over the globe with redwoods. Like, let's do it with the underwater redwoods, right? And so I think I'd see the great – like, I think in California we're working on this, something we call blue carbon zones, where you take, say, 2,000 acres, and it's part reforestation, part farming, part artisanal fishery.
Okay.
And all of that's working together, and you like pre-permit and treat it as these these blue carbon zones. And I think Australia, I think that's a really sort of soft, good target for that. But I'm no expert. I'd like look to someone like Dolane or others to.
Yes, no, and we'll certainly seek them out as well. It's more for me about if you were just thrown into a position like that. And I think that's exciting when you're talking about training people, young people, old people, whoever, that women, men, whoever they are. It's so you have training programs. Do you go and implement them yourself, or do you have a team of people that go around the world helping train, sharing their training for GreenWave?
Yeah, I'm a terrible trainer because, like, you know, I can't swim. I don't wear a life vest. I don't understand why, like, people whine when it's snowing, right? You know, like,
Can you really not swim?
Yeah. Most fishermen, northern fishermen, can't swim. They don't it's not. Yeah, we say it just prolongs your death. Like, if you're gonna fall in the Grand Banks, it's just like
fall. Just go with it.
Just like calm down, say goodbye, and just sink. Right. So I'm not a trainer, but I've got an incredible team of folks that go around training. We're running a extensive training program right now in Alaska with I think 6 different communities. And what our program is, it's a 2 to 3 year program. We help people go through the permitting process. We've got a great group of lawyers that works on that. We give people free seed. So, you know, seaweed and shellfish seed for a couple of years. They get gear from Patagonia, actually, who's a sponsor of ours. And then we find them markets as well for their crops. We have like a buyer's network. And then we do a lot of data collection and stuff on the farm. So it's a very intensive. Now, that said, we're also developing an online training platform. We're right in the middle of it now, which will allow people from all over the world to come together, learn, and we'll have training materials for people to start, because this stuff's not that complicated. Like, if you come to the farm, you'll be like, oh, I can do that. It's just, not, you know, you need a community to learn with, but like, to get started, it's not that complicated.
And is it about, actually, say, if I came to you and I said, I'm in Victoria in Australia, we learn about what's native to my area and we put the appropriate species into my ocean farm? Is that
in simple terms? When we move to a new area or support a new area, we only go places where we're supported, and we're more like just help, you know, like we don't have imperial ambitions, you know. But
take note.
We do a landscape analysis where we look at the ecosystem, the species, we look at the skill sets of the people, we look at the economic barriers and benefits in terms of market development, the latent infrastructure that's sitting there that can be revived. We look at the policy landscape, and then we put together this, and then we develop a program and training program and development program based on the landscape analysis. And that's really helped doing that early work to increase the chances of success for new farmers. And then we roll out the training program.
That's great. And tell me, just a couple of more questions about what do you enjoy eating? What's your favorite seafood from your farm?
It's a bad question because I eat at the gas station most nights. Like, I'm not a foodie. You know, I used to fish for McDonald's. And my favorite, most like family meal was my grandmother and I would go out to McDonald's and get a fish sandwich. And she used to love, she'd take a bite and she'd say, who knows, maybe it's one of yours, right?
Oh,
so like, I'm a big, like, I don't know, I like the grease on your mouth after a cheeseburger. You know, like, I'm not a foodie.
Oh, I hear you.
I'm part of this world and movement, which is great. And I'm allergic to shellfish. So.
Oh, wow. Really?
So,
all of it? What about fish? Do you eat? Go on. Sorry.
But I have – my wife's a foodie. And so the way I really like the – there are certain seaweeds that are extremely mild and have a really good mouthfeel. And the sun, so as you grow more and more and more places, you realize there's something called a terroir, like a terroir with wines. Everywhere you grow, there's a different flavor and a different texture.
Of course.
And it's a matter of cooking and preparing around that. So on my farm, we have a, we're in the southern region of this sugar kelp that we grow. So it's very delicate. It's not rubbery. It has a mild flavor. When you cook it, it turns bright green. And it's not salty or anything. So it's a really, really good, like, gateway drug for us. So that's a seaweed I really like. But you'd, many others, you know, aren't for me. But we don't have to just eat the seaweed. Like, we work with companies that do are doing, you know, mushroom and seaweed burgers and jerkies.
Yeah.
And there are just some great companies out there doing really innovative stuff with around the taste piece. So, but I'm not. For, my book has a bunch of recipes from famous chefs, but you know, I couldn't tell.
Do you work with a couple of high profile chefs around the States? Like, are they tapping into what you're doing? And do you wholesale to restaurants?
Yeah. So I used to do a lot of restaurants, farmers markets, things like that. And now I like corporate on the food end. I really like corporate cafeterias. We work with Google and a bunch of other places that are trying to attract talent with good food every day because the volume's high enough. We're rolling out a line of products and we're supporting Patagonia and a bunch of value added products that are coming. Patagonia, the, you know, clothing and climbing store.
Yep.
We work with like everybody, you know, on my farm has been Katie Kwong is from Australia, right?
Kylie Kwong, the chef.
So she's been on my farm. Kylie,
Oh, wow,
she's
great.
Been on my farm. Renee Renzeppi, David Chang, Alex Attila, like most famous chefs in the world. They're all wonderfully supportive and really trying to change the thinking around these, you know, around these particular crops. I will say it's amazing to dive into this and realize that seaweeds, for example, are not just an Asian cuisine. There's an entire lost culinary history in the West of eating seaweeds. Wherever there have been ocean cultures, they've been eating seaweed. So the seaweed was in Irish bars and Scottish bars, it was a bar snack that everybody ate. The French used to pickle it, and it was, Italians used it in sauces all the time. It was used in gin, and like everywhere you go, you find out it was just pushed off the plate. And so it's a matter of like reviving. And then, you know, in the U.S. in San Diego, there were 1,500 workers in 1910 processing kelp into 52 different products in the U.S.
Get out of here. Wow.
1910. Totally lost. No one knows this. So everybody's like, oh, is this all Asian? And no, there's this incredibly long history. It's just been forgotten. So in my book, I write a whole bunch about the history here because I didn't know it, and it's fascinating to
It is. So it's time to bring it back to the plate, isn't it?
Yeah. Climate change is demanding us to search our history for the right solutions. And I think this is one, you know, small piece of the puzzle.
And I think also to sort of wrap up, I think also climate change is asking and insisting that we listen to the earth again. So everything you listen to the planet, I should say. So everything you said about listening to the ocean and really hearing her and saying this is what we need to do and listening to the land and having the land. Well, because if the land's unhappy, the ocean's unhappy. We know that they work together. And I think we're very passionate about that here at the Apollo Bay Seafood Festival as well. And so how do we find you on GreenWave? Do you want to do a shameless plug for us?
Sure. If you just go to greenwave.org, greenwave.org, and you can come and sort of, you know, come join our community and get information. The book we wrote is Eat Like a Fish, My Adventures as a Fisherman Turned Restorative Ocean Farmer. And that's a salty tale. Don't give that to your kids. Because it's got my time in jail and like the whole thing. One reviewer said, God, I feel bad for his mom.
But she still loves you, I'm sure.
But anyway, so there's a shameless plug. And then, just, you know, all hands on deck. And it's an exciting space. Like, we can go out in the ocean and do food and agriculture right. Like, we can build this from the bottom up. There are not many industries you can start from the beginning And, like, make sure it's not privatized. Make sure seed stays in public hand. Make sure that people who have been left behind in society get access to this new industry. Make sure that it's, you know, local, delicious, native crops that we're growing. All this sort of thing. Like, we get to plan and do it right. And I think that's why there's 4,000 people on the waiting list, because it's so interesting to try to build something from the bottom up and from the ground from the beginning.
And as you say, and it's yours, and you're accountable for it, and you can feed your community and connect with your community and your people.
Exactly. But
look, I was going to say, Brent Smith, thank you so much.
Really, it's a total honor.
We need you to actually come out to Apollo Bay 1 year, February. Bring the family. Bring your wife and little Willa. He'll be bigger then.
Yeah.
And we would love to have you 1 year. Can we keep in touch?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it'd be an honor. Just, you know, don't take me swimming. That's the one.
No, clearly. No, we're not taking you swimming. That's okay. Swimming. We all swim out here, so we're all good swimmers, I hope. Yeah. But look, thank you so very much, and all the best to you and your team and your family, and here's to the ocean.
Yeah, absolutely. Here's to the ocean. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Stay in touch. Okay, bye-bye.
See ya. Bye.
You pulled. That was beautiful, Hillary.
Thank you. Yeah. He was a pleasure to interview, and he's funny and smart and can't swim, and is allergic to seafood. But he is. I think he's a visionary, and it's very exciting what he's developing.